I'm John Dankosky from New England Public Radio.
And I'm Rose Scott from WABE in Atlanta. Welcome to America Amplified, Life, Community, and COVID-19. This is where public radio stations across the country team up to talk about life and how it's changed because of the pandemic.
This hour, we'll examine the impact of COVID-19 within communities of color.
We'll discuss how the lack of early data reflects these racial disparities and what are the long-term effects and consequences within these communities.
And you are, of course, invited to be part of this conversation. Post comments about your own experiences on Twitter at Amplified2020. We want to start our conversation with Dr. Orlando Torres. He's from Bay State Health in Springfield, Massachusetts. He works at the High Street Health Center. Dr. Torres, welcome to America Amplified.
Thank you for having me.
Doctor, first of all, maybe you can describe the clinic where you see tens of thousands of patients a year. Tell me about who you primarily see and what it's been like since that this pandemic hit.
Absolutely. First, a shout out to all veterans this week, and especially those veterans who represent the people of color. And thank you for providing a voice to us and having a discussion with everyone about this important topic. So to provide context, Bay State High Street Health Center Adult Medicine is one of three community health centers within Bay State Health. It serves the greater Springfield area in Hampden County, Western Massachusetts, and which has a population of about 500,000 folks. Our clinic, like I mentioned, serves about 10 to 12,000 unique patients and more than 30,000 patients visits a year. And there are three other clinics which are comparable in size and that work collaboratively to care for the most vulnerable at Hampden County, which ranks 14 out of 14 in the Massachusetts regarding health outcomes. Hampden County represents, has about 26% Hispanics versus 12% the state. The percentage of non-Hispanics Blacks is about 7.7%, which is very similar to the state. And to put things in context, the percent of children in poverty is about 26% versus 12% within the state. And the percent of children in the single-parent households is about 47% versus 31% within the state. Also, the PCP ratio is about 1,400 patients to one provider and 900, when compared to 970 patients to one provider within the state.
My goodness. So really, you're talking about a population that is exactly the population that we're talking about for this hour. What have things been like since the pandemic hit, since coronavirus hit in Western Massachusetts?
Well, as you can imagine, our clinic represents about 50% Latino within our patient panels, of which half of those folks are non-English proficient. And our percentage of non-Hispanic Blacks is about 20%. I also want to include refugees and seasonal workers, migrants who come, who we attend at the clinic. And our experience within the clinic really involves a couple of actions. One was, I think it's, this is one of those topics where you ask yourself, where do we start, recollecting about what occurred over the past 10 weeks, 11 weeks now. Mm-hmm. So during the week of March 15th, that's when the states started the containment measures and the approaches to keep folks at home. So first and foremost, we asked our patients to stay at home. And we essentially converted the clinic into an urgent telephonic care center. This was done with the advice of the leadership within the Bay State Health System. And the goal was to essentially screen for COVID positive symptoms. And if they were positive, then we would actually try to attend the issue over the phone. But if they had any urgent matters, we would still see them with the proper measures. And so we actually did see COVID positive patients who needed to be seen with the proper mitigations. Mm-hmm. In terms of one important aspect is actually how do we keep the healthcare workforce safe? So in terms of our employees, we had to also do a lot of mitigation within our clinic, which is implementing masking and social distancing guidelines in a very busy office environment, about 60 staff members. And we needed to reassure them and gain their trust over the coming weeks that, you know, coming to work was safe. One of our employees at our community health center was even at risk of homelessness because the family members at home said, hey, if you come to the clinic, you might be the source of our infection here in our household. And I mentioned this because our clinic, you know, essentially is a representation of the community itself. When we move forward to March 22nd, that week, that's when the number of cases started to come in more often. So what we would see also is that the initial patients who called with COVID symptoms would call a second time, usually 7 to 10 days out, saying, you know, I'm actually having difficulty participating in my basic activities of daily living. And that means I'm having difficulty just walking from my, you know, bedroom to the kitchen to the bathroom. So they were just having the basic activities of the daily living problems. And at that instance, you need to wonder, you know, are you having difficulty with your, you know, oxygenation and ventilation? Mm-hmm. So that week, essentially, we did see a surge in those second calls and a surge in the hospitals. The ICU that weekend, for example, went from an average census of 15 to 20 to 60 in 3 to 5 days. Mm-hmm. And the peak the week later, essentially, did see a total of 170 patients hospitalized.
If you're just tuning in, this is America Amplified, Life, Community, and COVID-19. Alongside John Dankowski from New England Public Radio, I'm Rose Scott from WABE in Atlanta. Dr. Torres, I do want to talk about, you and I both know, and everyone knows that folks with chronic health conditions face a greater risk. But there are also some other factors here, and often it's access to quality health care to begin with. Is this the case for many of the patients that have come into your health center?
I got to say, in New England, Massachusetts, the access to care, yes, it's challenging, but the dynamics around access to care are a little bit different. I want to say that first and foremost, we have commitment from our leadership within the health system. Not only when the patients come in for their health issues and, you know, for diagnosis and treatment, we are asking and screening for the social determinants of health. And to give an example, we ask about economic stability, neighborhood and physical environment questions, housing insecurity questions, food insecurity, and we put the total care in context. And our advantage that's unique to our community is that we are part of an ACO, which is an accountable care organization. What that means that, for example, Medicaid in Massachusetts provide us with a lump sum to care for a very specific amount of patients. And that actually relieves us from doing volume-based care, which is 10, 20 minutes with the patient interacting, and then you go back home, the patient goes back home, we see them again in three to four months to, hey, let's just check in telephonically, or let's just do other approaches to not only attend your medical issues, but talk to you more about your, you know, mental health, housing insecurities. And we have employed community health workers so that they can help the doctors and the advanced practitioners care for the patient as a whole.
Mm. Dr. Torres, you just talked about leadership there in your area. Well, how would you assess getting the message out to get folks, especially Hispanic and Black Americans, into at least getting early testing? How would you assess that campaign up there?
The most important thing is public service announcements and communicating via the different, you know, media outlets. And including this one, so I'm really thankful for this. But it's essentially communicating back with our community. To give an example, our clinic not only attended the urgent phone calls, but proactively called out patients to determine if they had any issues, any concerns, attend any anxiety. As you can imagine, after the 10th week, there's a lot of folks who just are not doing well. We did see an uptick in domestic violence and other issues because now, to give an example, if a patient was vulnerable because of that problem, they are now potentially with the person who is verbally or other means abusing our patient. Mm-hmm. So having the barometers in addition to the medical care out there with our community health workers and other means meant a lot. Mm-hmm.
I just want to remind you that you're listening to America Amplified, Life, Community, and COVID-19. If you want to join our conversation about health inequities in COVID-19, tweet us at Amplify2020. Dr. Torres, I'm wondering if you can just talk briefly with us, if you would, on the personal level. When we talk about health inequities around an issue like this, do you have stories from your own family? Is there something in your life that you're particularly thinking about right now at this time when this disease is hitting so much harder in the Latino and Black communities? And just briefly,
absolutely.
If you would.
Sure, absolutely. The experience of staying at home, isolated, and taking all the measures when going out to the store is life changing. So it's a new process, procedures, and the other caveat is the economic. We could spend the whole afternoon talking about the economic impact taken.
Dr. Torres, Torres, I hate to interrupt because you're absolutely right. We're going to get to that on the other side of this break. So hold on to that thought for me, okay? We're talking COVID-19 and disparities. This is America Amplified. Tweet us at Amplified 2020. We'll be right back. This is America Amplified.
Welcome back. I'm John Dankosky from New England Public Radio.
And I'm Rose Scott from WABE in Atlanta. This is America Amplified, Life, Community, and COVID-19. And this hour, we're talking about the impact of the disease within specific racial and ethnic communities. And as our conversation continues, we're joined by Dr. Orlando Torres from Bay State Health High Street Health Center in Springfield, Massachusetts. And Dr. Torres, before we went to break, you were going to share a very personal story about all of this.
Absolutely. The fact that this is a shared story amongst everyone who has to stay at home, isolated with homeschooling, it's a challenge to not only do your full-time job, but to care for several kids and serve as a teacher, educator, attend your work. And the impact of the going outside with limited, access to things, it's very stressful for our family and everyone. So mm-hmm. A shout out to all the households, folks staying at home. It's not easy.
We're going to get a lot more of these ideas from people around the country right now. Tweet us at Amplify2020. But first, we want to hear from a few folks across the Midwest who have firsthand experience with this pandemic hitting their communities especially hard.
Hi, my name is Lanaya Mead, and I live in Kansas City, Kansas. My sister, she's only 9. She got really anxious. She started having panic attacks because she was scared that she was going to get sick. POCs are being diagnosed more with COVID than everyone else, and I feel like one day that'll come to blame that people of color have been giving it to people. This has brought us together, but also I feel like soon it will tear us apart.
Hey, my name is Chris. I am from Denison, Iowa. I'm 18 years old. Denison is a meat packing plant town that supplies a lot of jobs to immigrants and people of minority. With everything reopening up these past few couple weeks, this county has shown an increase in people infected. It has caused people that I know of, family, friends, to be struck by the virus. Even though we're going through hard times, we manage to get through things.
Hi, Hi, my name is Kathy Daniels. I'm also known as Mama Cat. I live in Florissant, Missouri. To understand how coronavirus can affect a whole group of people, you must understand how we got to where we were historically. We had to eat to survive. We ate things that was not good for our body, items with high sugars and high salts. We didn't know better because that's all we had. For a while in St. Louis, 100% of the COVID-related deaths were Black people. We knew that it was time for us to sit down and reassess how we're going to go forward. I just wish that we lived in a society where the powers that be, once it's discovered that Black people are disproportionately affected by COVID, don't decide that it's a good time to open back up the economy. It's like they saying, oh, they dying? Okay, cool. Next? No, we should not have to live in that way. I won't live in that way, and neither should anyone else.
That audio diary came to us from our coordinating producer, Andrea Tudhope. We're talking about the racial and ethnic inequities in American healthcare and how the coronavirus pandemic is making them even worse. Tweet us at Amplified2020.
And we continue our conversation with Dr. Orlando Torres from Bay State Health High Street Health Center in Springfield, Massachusetts. Along with now, we welcome into the conversation Dr. Valerie Montgomery Rice, President and Dean of the Morehouse School of Medicine here in Atlanta, Georgia. Dr. Valerie Montgomery Rice, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Rose and John, for having me today.
Dr. Rice, here's what we know. Reports reveal there are higher rates of COVID-19 infections, hospitalizations, and deaths within the Black and Hispanic and even Native American communities. What does this say to you about the lack of access, perhaps, to early testing for these communities?
You know, when I think about this, and I was listening to your stories, and one of the stories really hit a point that when we know better, we should do better. So we know that we're seeing this disproportionate number of people of color are being impacted by COVID-19. We know, if we were to really look at the data, that it is because those persons are in the front line. And I'm not talking about front line just from being healthcare workers, and those are very important people. I'm talking about front line who are the people who are delivering our foods, who are working in the meatpacking plants, the people who are continuing to make sure we have our Amazon delivered, the people who are cleaning the hotels, the people who are servicing us. And so those persons are not able to socially distance. So just like we would for our healthcare workers who are providing an extraordinary service, taking care of people on the front line, we too should be having testing for those individuals. And then we have to go another step though. We have to create an opportunity and a resource for them to quarantine when they become infected. And that may mean that they cannot go back to their household that may have multi-generational people. It may mean that we have to provide a resource that allows them 14 days or so to quarantine, get them into care with daily symptom checking, et cetera, such that if their symptoms escalate, we could get them into care in another setting a lot faster. So when we know better, we ought to do better.
Well, given what you just said, Dr. Rice, some would say, well, how easy is that? Or that's not easy to provide that resource to quarantine and then be able to allow folks to get the treatment that they need, especially if that essential worker is the one bringing in most of the income in said household.
Well, that's the other thing. We were able to come up with an opportunity for people to get the stimulus checks, right? Mm-hmm. And we did that pretty rapidly. So I believe we do have the capacity, and it will take a will. I believe we do have the opportunity to ensure that people will be able to maintain their employment during that time or receive some type of federal subsidy during that time to support themselves and their family. for those 14 days, because what we will get within that 14 days will be such a great return on investment when we are able to have that person quarantined to mitigate the spread of the disease, not only to their families, but to the persons they are out in contact with, trying to deliver service to the ones of us who do have the capacity to self-quarantine or to shelter at home.
Dr. Rice, it's John Dankosky here in New England. And I'm wondering, you know, we heard some of those voices from the Midwest, and some of what they had to say really speaks to this idea that the overall quality of healthcare for African Americans and Latinos in America before this entire pandemic hit was a real crisis that we just weren't taking a very close look at. And now we're seeing it. We're seeing these numbers in stark reality. How much of a factor is that? The fact that the Black community just wasn't getting the type of health care across the board that it needed to before coronavirus hit.
So, John, you bring up a good point, and I want to make sure that we understand that we have two issues here. We have an issue that we had a systemic challenge with not just health care access, but care delivery and the quality of care that happens that really does contribute to the fact of people's ability to manage their chronic disease. I think one of the persons in your story said something about, and it was a really good analogy that brought it home. When people are trying to survive, they don't always do all the quote unquote right things, eat the right foods, have access to being able to exercise in a safe environment, have access to being able to take the medications that they're prescribed. And so we know that there have been systemic challenges in the healthcare system that have served as barriers to people not being able to make the right choice because they just didn't want to make the right choice, but they did not have a right choice put in front of them. So you got those systemic challenges. Now, if you combine that, so now I'm a person who has a chronic disease that I'm trying to manage that has been a systemic challenge for me. When I am in an environment where I cannot socially distance and I come into contact with someone who is infected, who then infects me, okay? So when the virus decides to infect me, it doesn't know that I'm Black, that I'm white, that I'm Hispanic, that I got diabetes or hypertension. It just knows that I'm a person who's coming into contact with someone who is already infected. So I get the virus. Then I have more of a challenge. I have more morbidity with the fact that I have this chronic disease. So people need to make sure that we understand that there's been a systemic challenge of us managing the health disparities in these underserved communities. And it's about access and opportunity, access to care, and then opportunity to the highest quality of care, even when I have access. And now when you lay on top of that, this virus, which really does affect many of the areas of the body that align with our health disparities. When you see people talk about it impacts the kidney, it impacts the GI tract, it impacts the heart, it impacts these areas. So when I have something that directly attacks those areas, then I'm going to have more morbidity. And so what my recommendation for us, not even a recommendation, I would say my thought would be that this virus has unveiled for us what we've already known. And it's made people feel uncomfortable because they see how systemic our challenges have been. And that is why we have not been able to overcome some of the disparities that we've seen, is because we haven't put the work in front of us. We haven't done the work that would lead to greater access and improvement of quality of care. And this virus has just shown us that even more.
Well, let's get in some conversation now. Let's go to Elena, who's calling from Atlanta. Welcome to America Amplified.
Thank you for being there. I am concerned because I'm African American and I am in the risk group. I haven't been able to get around in months. I find that if we could put a N95 mask, 95 because it keeps out 95% of the virus, on everybody, starting with the healthcare workers and then my community of seniors and African Americans and other seniors, you will be able to open your economy. You will be able to move forward. There should be at least 3 factories, depending on the number of population in each state. They should be passed out more liberal than you can find toilet paper. And it should be something that is a priority, and this government knows how to do it. We watch you build tanks during World War II when we had nothing but horses when we first started that war. And between Ford and GM, you were able to gear up and weaponize the entire world. You rebuilt Europe with the Marshall Plan. Put the masses out there, and you don't have to worry about anybody wearing them. The virus doesn't have feet. It depends on people, like the doctor said, to transmit it. Give me a mask. Don't give me no paper mask. I want an N95 by 3M.
Yeah. Eliana, thank you so much for your thoughts and your call. I'm going to go to Victor. Let's go to Kurt first. Kurt is calling from Douglas, Arizona. Hi there, Kurt. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Doing well. What's on your mind, Kurt?
Well, we need more isolation. It's hitting the bigger cities. And the reason why, probably because it's hitting the bigger cities, because there's more people, and it's gonna flood the bigger cities. When you're in the little cities, it's not gonna affect too many people. But the main thing is this: a great man said, "It's not what you can do for your country; it's not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country." When our government says stay home, it means stay home. You have bars that are open, and that's not correct. It's hard to stay at home. But the main thing is that we need to stay at home, because more people out, we're going to have more of a chance of catching this.
And Kurt, thank you very much for your thought. I want to get a quick thought from Dr. Torres on that. Dr. Torres, you know, I'm in Connecticut, you're in Massachusetts. Just within the last couple of days, things have started to open up here. What Kurt's saying is maybe we're opening up too fast. Maybe we got too many people out on the streets. Are you worried for the community that you serve that we're going to start to see an uptick in cases once again?
Well, absolutely. There's a saying that about this COVID-19 that just follow the population density maps. That's where you'll find the disease. It's really sad, and it's challenging because there's no central government coordination. And people are struggling, meaning patients and populations in big cities, smaller towns, et cetera. But the healthcare workers also have been struggling with obtaining the personal protection equipment, including the N95s and the the blue masks, ERLP ones. So I cannot speak to that part, because I would do things very differently. My beliefs are, have a background in engineering and supply chain and manufacturing. And, frankly, at times like this, that's when either folks know how to do things or don't. And right now there's no coordination, and everyone is at a local level. It's just struggling obtaining the appropriate equipment at the hospital and clinical
yeah,
level.
And you heard our friend from Atlanta calling up and telling us maybe we need to just get more people making those masks. And I don't know, Rose, we're hearing that from a lot of people too. In Atlanta, they're saying that make more masks. That's going to help people in the cities and everywhere else.
Yeah, we're hearing that. It's a national security issue.
Yeah.
We're hearing that. The question is also, could more lives have been saved? Did the U.S. move too slow in preparing and implementing measures? Let's try to get in Victor, who's calling from Bucks County in Pennsylvania. Victor, welcome to America Amplified.
Yes, I'm originally worked a lot in Europe, and I come back to the United States. I can't believe how much it has fallen, going down the drain as far as the inequities, especially towards blacks and Hispanics, but also the poor whites in Appalachia. I personally believe, and so is some from United Way, as also the people who were backing Bernie Sanders, believe that this is deliberate to get rid of all the poor people.
Victor, thank you very much for your phone call. We actually heard a few voices like that actually rose in that piece of tape that we got from the Midwest, right? We were hearing a lot of people who were pretty concerned.
Well, here's the thing, John. What we know about this virus is that it does not discriminate. So regardless of your income, regardless of your ethnicity, everyone has a, everyone could be could contract this virus, that we do know. But the conversation is about those specific communities that are getting hit the hardest. And that's what we're talking about, inequities in healthcare, which Dr. Rice alluded to. This is nothing new. And so that's how our conversation continues.
We'll be right back. This is America Amplified.
And welcome back. I'm Rose Scott from WABE in Atlanta.
And I'm John Dankosky from New England Public Radio. This is America Amplified, Life, Community, and COVID-19. We're talking this hour about health-related disparities in communities of color due to the coronavirus pandemic. Now, there's still time for you to join this conversation. Tweet us at Amplified2020.
Let's welcome in Vanessa Sarazuza, Executive Director of the Gainesville-based Hispanic Alliance of Georgia. Now, if you're not familiar, this is an area in the northeastern part of the state that over the past few weeks has seen an increase in confirmed COVID-19 cases. Vanessa, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
For listeners not familiar with Gainesville, Georgia, can you give a brief snapshot of this population?
Well, Gainesville is the poultry capital of the world, and we have, I think it's the largest migrant county in the state of Georgia, cutting up chicken and producing, chicken for the state, and about 30% of it goes in exports. So it's one of the major industries of Gainesville. We also have other manufacturing industries there, like Kubota and others. And it is the, it has the largest concentration of immigrant workforce in the nation, actually. So we have a lot of Latinos that work very hard, who daily have to get up for work. And because of this epidemic, did exactly that the next day after everybody else stayed home with this COVID.
And Vanessa, we understand that after this, there was this announcement, the report that in this area of Georgia, it had been deemed a hotspot. Your organization has been partnering with others to address this surge and confirm cases. What efforts have you all been doing?
Well, as soon as we saw, our community, unfortunately, was already living in poverty. So about 6 months ago, we decided that we needed to open access for food for our community, since we saw a gap there for our poor community. And since then, we received a very large donation of dry goods, and now we have our own food bank. And so we started, this month, we started doing a drive-through to relieve our community that was either quarantined without pay, unemployed, or ill. So we did the drive-through, and we had 750 families go by in May. We're doing our next one in June. We expect at least that amount, if not more. And so through different corporation partners that we have, we've been able to kind of tap into the excess of retail food that's there and be able to relieve our poor community at the same time through these drive-throughs. And then we also, during the week, we help people with food boxes that are either when they're either quarantined and can't get out, or if they haven't worked in the last month because they work construction, which is another industry. And so we, for people that have been affected directly with COVID, we have, with our volunteers, leave a food box at their door. And we've done that for the last month and a half, 2 months. And so we've seen about 76 families a week that receive a food box with enough food for about a week, and minimum about 35 a week throughout this ordeal. And just this last week on Monday, we had 60 families that actually needed a food box. And now they're all asking about next Tuesday when we go back into work, if we're going to deliver those food boxes or if we're going to have those food boxes available at the office for them to pick up.
Vanessa, stand by for a second because we want to take some phone calls from around the country. Ayana is calling from Philadelphia. Hi there, you're on America Amplified.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Of course. What's on your mind?
I've been very concerned. My mom lives in Brooklyn, New York, and she's 77 years old. My uncle is 78 years old. And at the very height of the pandemic in New York City, I came up on April 1st to get my uncle out of the hospital after having a stroke. And a lot of people, of course, are not able to quarantine with their family member for various reasons. My uncle would have been going to another rehab center. But because of the virus, I decided to just quarantine with him. And thank God that worked out fine. What I've been really concerned about is in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, my mom has been a homeowner for over 30 years and always enjoyed wonderful relationships with the community, including members of all different races and including the Hasidic community. But one of the concerns that I have is just the total disregard and lack of respect for social distancing. And it's very, very difficult to address because we love our neighbors. We love our rabbis. We don't want to go back to the tensions of the 80s and the 90s. But every time I go home, I witness with my own two eyes gatherings that are happening, people still not wearing face masks. And my mom and her brother are holed up in their home for now almost 3 months. So I just wish that we could come to some type of respect and understanding that if we could just be respectful, wear masks, social distance, and not continue to hold gatherings, we don't want to be offensive. And it comes, of course, unfortunately, as singling out a particular group when that really is not the intention. And so it really saddens me. I lost a family member myself in his 60s. He did have underlying diabetes. I'm a registered nurse who just turned down a position as an RN care manager because I was that devastated and afraid in New York City. So I'm not on the front lines, but I continue to grow concerned about why can't we just have the respect for one another to just obey social distancing? I don't understand it.
Ayana, thank you so much for that. Go ahead, Rose.
Hey, John, let's check in with Randy, who's calling from Buford, Georgia. Randy, thanks for taking the time to call us. We appreciate it.
Yes, Rose. I just have a small comment to make.
Sure.
I'm white. I'd like to tell my white brothers and sisters that we're all people of color. And my black brothers and sisters, yellow, red, brown, the table could turn, and it could affect us the way that apparently I'm hearing it's affecting the people of color. So I would just like to say that we're all humans and we need to help each other on this thing. And that's about all I got to say.
Randy, thank you so much for that. A lot of people feel that same way. How about Bill in Pittsburgh? Bill, thanks for taking the time to call.
Hi. In no way is this meant to minimize the impacts on African Americans and Hispanics being unequal. But I worked when I was considerably younger, in poor white urban communities, housing projects that were mostly white. And I think we need to also look at what's happening to poor white people, especially to make it more comparable in urban areas, and find out what's happening, how much is poverty and how much is racism, because poor whites are also, I happen to be obese, but I'm not poor. I'm also diabetic and, obese and maybe not eating well or exercising, etc.
Okay. Well, you know what? That's Bill, you bring up some good points. And Dr. Valerie Montgomery Rice, I want you to chime in on, we know that there are some specific factors that, whether it's based on your socioeconomic status, having underlying conditions, the rural community, poor communities, Bill is saying, look, those communities, those are the ones that are getting hit the hardest, and something needs to be done.
So thank you, Bill. And I appreciate all the points that your callers have been making. And Bill, what I will say to you is, again, I think Rose said it, this virus does not discriminate. Okay, so it does infect you based on your proximity. We at Morehouse School of Medicine did a study where we looked at the number of cases by county. And then we compared that with a couple of factors. We looked at poverty levels. We looked at the population density. We looked at uninsured rates. And we looked at whether or not what the percentage of Blacks in a county were. And what we were able to show was that for every 1% increase in the proportion of Black people in the county, it represented 2.3% increase in the county COVID-19 confirmed case rate. And that is, we believe, because of it was a place-based, and you go on and look at what type of jobs these people have, you see that they're on the front line, and so they are getting more infected. I believe that if we go to any urban area and we see where people are not able to socially distance, we're going to see that. There was a San Francisco study that showed us something very similar with the Hispanic population in the City Mission District. And it looked at 90% of the cases there were people who were essential workers. They were those people who were still getting up, as Vanessa described, and going to work, working in the factories, driving the buses, doing all those things when other people were able to quarantine. Mm-hmm. So I think if you go to an urban area and you look at or a rural area and you see areas where you have a white population that may have more essential jobs, I think if you see them coming into contact with one another, you will see similar rates of infection. Mm-hmm. So I think that is really about people not being able to socially distance, because that's one thing that we know, we believe, has really helped to flatten the curve.
Mm-hmm. That's Dr. Valerie Montgomery Rice. I'm John Dankosky from New England Public Radio. I'm joined by Rose Scott from WABE in Atlanta. And this is America Amplified, Life, Community, and COVID-19. Still got time to take a few more calls and questions, thoughts from people around the country. Let's go to Susan. Susan is in Jackson, California. Hi there, Susan.
Hi, how are you today? And I raised my children in the Springfield area, so I feel like I'm talking with friends.
Glad to have you here.
What I wanted to say, yeah, and it's very calm here in rural Amador County, so we have very few cases, but I think, unfortunately, people are not paying attention. But the reason I called was, you know, I think the pandemic is just pointing out and highlighting the disparities that have been going on for so long. And when I lived in Springfield, I had the wonderful opportunity of being a retail dietitian, which means I worked for a large local chain, and I did nutrition education in stores with people. And I cannot tell you how many people didn't know how to eat for their diabetes. You know, somebody told them, oh, just don't eat any carbs, or they didn't know what to do for their high blood pressure or for their kidney disease. And we taught people, we didn't charge them. And I think if a public health measure were to address teaching people about nutrition in the grocery store. And, you know, there's a whole other issue of food deserts, and Springfield has lots of food deserts where all you got is these little bodegas or tiny little markets that don't cater to a large array of people. And it's just a simple, it's low tech. All I need is a pencil and a paper, and you can change people's lives. And I had people say, oh, I never knew this. Oh, thank you. We would teach people about healthy eating on a budget. And these are easy measures that people in public health realms can hire dietitians on their public health team. And you do this for people, and it's wonderful.
Well, Susan, thank you so much for your phone call. And you know, Rose, we've talked a little bit about that, about diet, about some of the underlying conditions. And she brings up something else that's really important in a lot of urban areas in America, food deserts, places where you just can't buy anything other than just, you know, junk food off the shelves.
Well, John, let me tell you, here in the Atlanta area, we have many communities where we call our food insecure. So you would think that wouldn't be happening in a city like Atlanta, but it is. Let's go to, speaking of Atlanta, let's go to Tawanda. Tawanda, who's calling from Atlanta.
Hello, I am Tawanda from Atlanta, and I wanted to talk about how historically the Black community has been underdiagnosed, no matter what their social economic background is. And it's also included in this pandemic, where we've heard a lot about Black people having underlying medical conditions and also being frontline workers. But what has not been mentioned is the disparity in our diagnosis and treatment. I have a number of friends that had symptoms early on during the early cases of days of COVID, and they weren't given tests. They were told to go home and treat with water over a hot boiling pot and different other things that didn't really make sense, even though they were well-educated and had really great insurance. So I think historically, this also hits us really hard because we're underdiagnosed, and none of those friends were given tests. So those five friends working later from home were not given tests, nor were they hospitalized, but they did hit.
Thank you so much for that, Tawanda.
Let's see if we can get one more phone call in here. We're going to Tammy. Tammy's also in Georgia. Tammy's in Monticello. Is it Monticello or Monticello? Rose, you're going to tell me.
I'm going to ask Tammy to answer that.
Tammy will know.
Sorry, I don't actually live there. I'm living in my RV and driving around the state and visiting different parts because I am essentially furloughed from my job.
Gotcha. But, what's on your mind, Tammy? Yeah.
Well, I was very, just as I think the term social distancing is poor, it should be physical distancing. I would rather see the stats as like our essential workers or populations that can't get apart from each other as opposed to labeling it Black and, I mean, maybe or in addition. But mainly because I've been very interested about the prison population, because I have a friend who on a violation for a probation violation ended up back in prison, and following the stats on that, which Georgia does publish, and we've had people die. The odds of dying in prison in different parts of the state are pretty high compared to the general population. So we have all these people that are afraid to go out when their odds of getting COVID are like very small, like 1 in 1,000. And then we have these other groups where they can't separate, like the essential workers and the prison population, and those odds are much higher. So that's where we need to draw the attention to. Are the people that are getting sick the people that cannot get away from being exposed to the germs? And how can we help them? And that is what I wanted to talk about.
Well, Tammy, thank you very much for your phone call. I appreciate it. I want to thank all of our guests, Vanessa Sarazuza from Gainesville in Georgia. We also heard from Dr. Valerie Montgomery Rice in Atlanta. And from right where I'm sitting, Dr. Orlando Torres, he is part of the Bay State Health System, and he sees an awful lot of patients each year. I want to thank all of them for all their contributions. Rose?
And you know, John, there were so many callers that we couldn't get to. There were so many conversations, so many tentacles tied to this COVID-19 and how it affects communities of color. We probably needed a whole nother hour on this, but we definitely appreciate everyone who took the time to call and talk about a very important issue right now in our society.
That's all the time we have. Thanks for joining us for America Amplified, Life, Community, and COVID-19. You can listen back to this episode at americaamplified.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
And today's show was produced by Grace Walker and John Vosey. A special thanks to WABE in Atlanta, KCUR in Kansas City, and New England Public Radio for all working together to bring these voices from across the country so important to your public radio station. And thanks also to an incredible team at America Amplified. It's a community engagement initiative supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Our technical director is Chris Pruitt, and our coordinating producer and director is Andrea Tuthope. Our executive producer is John Haas. The conversation doesn't end here, though. Find us on Twitter at Amplified2020. From New England Public Radio, I'm John Dankosky.
And I'm Rose Scott from WABE right here in Atlanta. And this has been America Amplified.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.